Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's Your Call, 12 Years a Slave screenwriter John Ridley joins us to talk about his new documentary, Let It Fall, Los Angeles, 1982 to 1992. The film explores the 1992 LA uprising, racial and economic inequality, and the police brutality that fueled the violence and unrest. I'm sure you remember that in 1992, the acquittal of four LA police officers accused of the brutal beating of the black motorist Rodney King sparked 5 days of deadly violent protests in Los Angeles. More than 50 people were killed, over 2,000 were injured, and the damage cost over $1 billion. A year earlier, Rodney King was pulled over by police after allegedly speeding and leading them on a high-speed chase. When they stopped him, Rodney King was ordered to step out, and then LA police officers repeatedly kicked him and savagely beat him with metal batons for 15 minutes. A grainy video showed more than a dozen cops standing by watching, and the world saw that video played over and over again. In the opening scene of the new documentary, Let It Fall, we read, "The Rodney King riots didn't start with Rodney King. They began 10 years earlier." Here is the trailer for John Ridley's new documentary, Let It Fall, Los Angeles, 1982 to 1992.
It's a domino effect. That domino tip is going to make the rest of them fall.
The Los Angeles police officially reprimanded Police Chief Darryl Gates.
We were having deaths from the chokehold.
He didn't get along with the community.
In the early 80s, the street gangs started to connect with the drug dealers.
It just got out of control.
Karen Tashima was killed in gang crossfire.
This is something that you always see on the news, and this time it happened to us.
We are determined to take back the streets of Los Angeles.
Operation Hammer was a free ticket to go out there and do overly aggressive police work.
And that was the New Lakers and all rebels.
What I witnessed at the scene was 100% LAPD policy.
Soon Ja Du, found guilty of killing a 16-year-old girl, received no jail time.
She got away with murder.
Black and brown people are being beat up, shot, choked to death by police forces all over this country.
We, the jury, find the defendant not guilty.
You just disrespect us like this? Like our lives don't matter?
Not guilty, the verdict for all of them.
We were sort of stunned.
We need to back out of here before we have to use deadly force.
It's like pouring gasoline and striking a match. It's not protest anymore. Now it's a full-blown riot.
I was a part of a movement, a black movement. There's a Florence and Normandy in every city and every state.
It was just one of those days compassion wasn't handed out to other races.
God told me to go save them, save that man's life.
You talked about guerrilla warfare, and it's right here.
18-year-old Edward Song Lee was shot to death.
That doesn't seem real. I felt like it couldn't be happening to us.
I know the anger, and I know exactly what my people are feeling.
We've lost the city. It's gone.
I want to know why God let this happen.
Unity, empowerment, they're not just cliches. We have to get ourselves together.
And that is the trailer for John Ridley's new documentary, Let It Fall, Los Angeles, 1982 to 1992. The documentary opens tomorrow at the Roxy in San Francisco. And you can watch that trailer or you can share it. It's at yourcallradio.org. John Ridley is an Oscar-winning screenwriter, director, and novelist. He's best known for his 2013 film, 12 Years a Slave, for which he won the Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. John Ridley is also the creator, director, and executive producer of ABC's Emmy-winning series, American Crime. His new documentary is called Let It Fall, and John Ridley joins me in studio. Hi, John. Thank you so much for coming in.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. Deeply appreciate it.
Well, we deeply appreciate you, and your film was really intense to watch because we're going through so much in this country right now. Why did you decide to take on this topic? And also, what I appreciated was when in the opening scene, it says that this didn't start with Rodney King. It started 10 years earlier.
Yeah. We actually, almost 10 years ago, the film director Spike Lee was really interested in doing a film narrative version of the LA Uprising, invited me to come in as a writer. And all of the things that I think make this story so compelling, that it's about many perspectives, that there are individuals who don't come into it to be heroic but end up having to be heroes. There are people whose actions turn deadly and turn against communities but don't wake up in the morning wanting to do evil to their fellow person. It's very gray. It's very broad-based. All of those things that I think make it a really compelling story actually made it very difficult to tell as a traditional Hollywood narrative. You know, the questions, and I say this without indicting Hollywood, it's obviously been very good to me, but whose story are we following? Who's the hero? Who's the villain? You know, can you tighten that up? How much money does it cost? All those things made it very prohibitive. So I'd been working on it for 10 years, was very familiar with these stories, how they interacted, this mosaic of Los Angeles. And I was eventually approached by ABC News, who didn't know that I'd been working on this story, and said, look, we want to do a news piece about the approaching anniversary of the uprising. I said, look, I know from 10 years of research and 10 years of looking at it that it's not about, and this is to your question, it's not about one incident that happened to one person that then affected one neighborhood. You could go back at least 10 years. There's an argument to go back further, but we begin at the end of what one could call the chokehold era in Los Angeles, where there was a submission technique used by the LAPD called the chokehold. There were a couple of variations of it, but disproportionately applied to black people at that time, because there was an assumption that a lot of individuals that the police interacted with in the black community were on PCP, were on drugs, that made them, and this was, again, this was an assumption, this was not even a reality, made them superhuman. And there was just then this cascade of events from the chokehold, the end of the chokehold era, to the introduction of the PR-24, which was the metal baton that was then used against Rodney King, the growth of crack cocaine within, or the explosion of its use within predominantly the inner city area, which at that time was known as South Central Los Angeles, just on and on and on. But we thought it was very important for people to realize that it wasn't as though the police assaulted an individual and then there was an uprising the next day, or a quote-unquote riot the next day, that Rodney King was not actually involved in the riot, that the riot itself didn't even start directly because of the verdict in Simi Valley, or the fact that the hearing was moved to Simi Valley, or that Rodney King was stopped in the Foothill Division, which is so far away from South Central. We really wanted people to have an understanding of the history, the timeline, the geography, the neighborhoods, these events that happen. Because without really understanding that, it does get reduced in time to, well, Rodney King was beaten, and then Reginald Denny was beaten. One was black, one was white. They were both terrible, but there was some kind of cosmic balancing of the scales, and we can all just move on. It's never that easy. Mm. It really isn't. And the people who are affected deserved a platform, in my opinion, to really share their stories, not just what we think we remember, not just my opinion or other people's opinions, their story about what they endured because of these events that happened over at least 10 years in time.
You did an incredible job of giving a voice to so many people affected by this and people involved in this. You did reach out to the four officers who beat and kicked Rodney King, and they refused to be interviewed. But you did interview so many other police officers, some who watched, and you interviewed family members, you interviewed people from South Central. It was incredible. How did you get such amazing access?
Well, I would say first with the officers, and it's just a little semantics, I would say they declined, maybe not quite refused, but we asked, we engaged with them on different levels, and in the end, some engaged with us, but they did not want to be interviewed on camera for many different reasons. How we got these other individuals, and we had, you know, Terry White, one of the prosecutors, police officers, one officer who was present for an individual by the name of James Mincy, who was one of the last African Americans to be killed by the chokehold method, but was also on location when Rodney King was beaten. Lisa Phillips, Terry Moulin, who was one of the commanding officer at 77th Division, which was the area that encompassed where the uprising took place. Bobby Green, Damian Williams, some of these folks, I don't want to say specifically who they are because the story unfolds a bit like a novel. Mm-hmm. We discover who they are. But how we got all these individuals really is a testament to our producers, who I work with at ABC News, who not just went to people and called them up and said, hey, we're doing this documentary, are you in or are you out? They quite literally went to various communities and sat with people and took time and really got to know them, and more importantly, allowed themselves to be known by these folks in various communities. Because to get these interviews, you really have to let folks know that you're approaching them with the sense that we want you to tell your story your way. We are not coming here so that your narrative fits into our discussion. It really only fits if you have an honest emotional velocity, a verbatim recollection of what it was you went through. And how do we line up these stories? There's some places in the documentary where we have two completely different individuals telling their stories, and we line them up so that we're able to cut back and forth. And there's a real seamlessness in their stories, and yet you can still see the difference of perspectives. One of the most unique evenings for me as just someone who's been fortunate enough to tell stories for many ways. We had a screening of our premiere of the documentary at the Black History Museum in Exposition Park in Los Angeles. So one of the most nerve-wracking times you can have for anyone, you know, when you tell stories is just your premiere, because you don't know how people are going to receive it. And then to have a premiere with individuals who trusted you and the people you work with enough to share incredibly emotional stories, just raw emotion. But then to have people from different communities who've historically in some ways been indoctrinated to not trust those other individuals, citizens and police, blacks and Asian Americans, Hispanics, people of means, people in distress, to have all of those individuals together in one night for the premiere of a documentary. And we were all just so anxious because you just didn't know how it was going to turn out. But when it was over, to have these folks really understand that they have shared an experience that most of us will not share, hopefully a lot of us will never have to share, but are bound by a history, but bound in a way that is not, it doesn't denigrate, it doesn't deflate. It in some ways elevates, because these folks survived something, and if they could do it and come out with a perspective and a humanity, the things that we go through that seem distressful that really aren't, you know, maybe we can actually take a lesson from them. And to me, that's what the film is about, is really examining the lives of individuals who have endured yet survived and thrived and call us to our better selves.
What is it like for you now that the film is coming out and you're going to be doing a lot of publicity at this time in our history? We've been doing so many shows about Charlottesville, yeah, race, you name it. And I always ask every guest, how do you explain this moment? I mean, what's going through your mind right now? We're talking about Confederate statues yesterday. The LA City Council, on a positive note, the LA City Council voted to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. This is in Los Angeles.
Yeah, of all places, which is good, because there's, you know, obviously there is so much history more than or beyond the prevailing culture, and we're moving towards that. This has been very difficult for me because under normal circumstances, look, anything you do, you want to do some kind of publicity because you want people to be aware of it. You want people to know about it. But there's another kind of publicity, major market publicity, where a lot of it is billboards or ads or advertising or very heightened events, and that's all wonderful. It's very good. This is a very personal direct sale. There's not a lot of money involved, and quite frankly, with documentaries, you can't really sell them on a broad-based advertising level. Because of documentaries, because of what they're about, because of the audience that is big and growing, thankfully, in this era, you know, you have so many people interested in documentaries, but it still is very much, you know, kind of a one-to-one, here's this story, here's why I found this story important. Here's why I believe you could find value in the story. So it's a lot of going to people. We were at the Black Harvest Film Festival. We've been at the Milwaukee Film Festival. As I said, we were at the Exposition Park. It's a lot of looking people in the eye. And in that, as you go from city to city, place to place, we do find ourselves in a lot of distress about race, about engagement, about police encounters, socioeconomic issues, all of the things that this film is about. And it's very sometimes it's very emotionally distressful to see folks individually. This is a story that, although the circumstances, the particulars, the singularity of this film is very specific to Los Angeles 25 years ago, the systemic issues remain. And to see folks, watching it and having very specific emotions, to be there with them, to be there with these audiences, it's tough. It's obviously not as tough as for the people that are represented in the film, but to know that 25 years later, again, a lot of the systemic issues remain. And there's so much pain and people looking for a way out and a way to move on, and we're not finding it yet. That is very difficult.
And I'm guessing when you do Q&As, people ask you, what changes would you make, right?
As a person who's dealt in this space about race and engagement, not just with Let It Fall, but American Crime and Guerrilla and 12 Years, people do look for a conclusion or an answer. And one of the things that I really tell people is I didn't go into this, and I don't want to present it as though there's an answer here. If I had the answer, I would try to work on that. And there are people who are a lot smarter than me, a lot more engaged. They don't have answers. If there was a piece of art that was going to answer these questions or really change society, somebody would have put that into the public space. I think a lot of times, I think personally, art is not about answering questions. It's about asking questions. Mm-hmm. And it's about creating a space where we can engage. One of the things that I find very special about this film, different than American Crime, which was an incredibly moving television show, very challenging television show, that wasn't something that necessarily played in a communal space. What's very important is to get folks to sit down together and at least go through the process of saying, if these individuals in this film from so many different communities can actually sit and talk about what they've been through, how come we can't sit and just talk? Mm-hmm. Because until we start talking as a society, as a group, as a nation, then we're certainly not going to get towards any answers.
Mm-hmm. During the interview process, when you spoke with people who were living in LA at the time, in South Central, former police officers, family members who've been affected, I'm sure a lot of things affected you. I'm sure you learned a lot. But what really stands out for you?
Just the immediacy of the emotions. Mm-hmm. That for all of these individuals, what we were talking about wasn't 25 years ago. It was yesterday. The specificity of detail. The film starts with this collection of individuals. We don't ID these people early on. And they're just talking about their memories. First, they're talking about very specific memories of the uprising. And then we shift to just their personal memories of their family, of their history, of when they moved to LA. So many of these individuals were transplants to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. How they grew up, what they remember.
A lot of immigrants.
Yeah. And I thought that was very important to remind people that, we all have investments. Particularly, I'll talk about Angelenos because I'm a transplant myself. There's so many people who come to Los Angeles because they wanted a better life, because there's so much promise, because, Los Angeles, California in general, Los Angeles in particular, is just that shining city. But even though we moved there to have this wonderful collective experience, once we, set roots, we become individualized in what we want, what we expect, it becomes ours. Even though that city is not necessarily ours, what we want, that becomes ours. And I thought it was very important to take this collection of individuals and let them share their sense of themselves. But as they talk about things, it's just so immediate. And that, more than anything, when you're sitting 3-4 feet across from an individual and their good memories are still very potent, but their difficult memories are just, they're lessons of the flesh and they are not easily unlearned.
Today we are speaking with John Ridley about his new documentary, Let It Fall, LA 1982 to 1992. The opening scene in the new documentary says the Rodney King riots didn't start with Rodney King. They began 10 years earlier. And this film does an amazing job of looking at so many issues, racial and economic inequality, deep poverty, easy access to cheap drugs, the police brutality that fueled the violence and the unrest. I hope you can see the documentary. It opens tomorrow across the country. It'll be at the Roxy here in San Francisco, and you can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. And if you have any questions or comments for John Ridley about this film, he interviewed so many people behind the scenes. He gives them a voice, lets them tell their own story. 866-798-8255. And if you were in LA at this time, where were you on April 29th, 1992? Or if you were just glued to your television scene like so many people around the world, what really stands out for you? And then, gosh, what has changed? When I was getting ready to watch the film, I saw an article called Cobb Cop. This is in the Georgia area. During a traffic stop, told a white woman who was afraid that he was going to shoot her when he stopped her. He said, "Remember, we only shoot black people." This is a story that I just found today, recently, as I was about to finish the film, I should say. John Ridley is out with a new documentary, Let It Fall. I mean, that's the thing, John. You keep saying, what has changed? And look at all of these stories. Yeah. And what I'm thinking right now is because of what's happening with Charlottesville and Trump, we're not really hearing about police brutality and what's happening in communities like we were last year, because there's so much happening so fast. If you look for it, you can find it. But it's not at the top of the list like it was last year.
I think part of the issue is that we don't hear about the systemic issues until there is an outsized event that forces us to look at what happened. You look at Ferguson, with the shooting in Ferguson that kicked off all the attention. The Department of Justice, when it was Eric Holder's Department of Justice, and I tend to trust perhaps that iteration of the Department of Justice a little bit more than perhaps the current iteration. But Eric Holder looked at it and said, look, as far as we can tell, the shooting was justified. However, there were a litany of systemic problems of daily police abuses, you know, and how they policed and how they monetized policing and how they engaged with the community that people didn't notice. And I would suspect that now that the cameras have moved on, they may still well be happening. So what we wanted to try to get at with Let It Fall in the documentary, again, was that what happened to Rodney King was not the sole event, and beyond that, you have people who just poured out into the streets. But over time, there was a cascade of events. They were interconnected, and that's what leads to people believing that they have no other recourse but to take to the streets and make themselves heard. So I absolutely agree with you. There are any number of things that are probably happening in various communities right now where people are not listening. They're not paying attention, because we are paying attention to these more outsized events. But we arrive to these larger events because of the daily grind of what's happening to individuals. Mm.
John Ridley's new documentary is called Let It Fall, Los Angeles, 1982 to 1992. And in the opening scene, we read that the Rodney King riots did not start with Rodney King. They began 10 years earlier. In 1992, the acquittal of four LA police officers accused of the brutal beating of black motorist Rodney King sparked 5 days of deadly violent protests. The other thing I was thinking when I watched this movie was, what if the man who had filmed the beating didn't have that camera? And remember, back then, obviously, there were no cell phone cameras.
I think that's the other thing people have to remember is that when this footage hit, it was a whole other era.
Right.
And people had talked about, you know, these were a phantom event, because there were people who talked about these kinds of beatings, these kinds of assaults. And we have people in the film who talked about, you know, what happened to Rodney King. That was bad, but that happened every day.
Yes. That was amazing. In fact, retired Detective Robert Simpach.
Simpach, yeah.
He was with the LAPD from 1974 to 2003. He drove up when the beatings were happening. He witnessed what was happening, and he told you this was 100% LAPD policy. He also said he knows of at least 10 incidents that were even worse.
And the way that he said it, and he didn't say it with maliciousness. He said it, you know, well, that was policy. And I looked at it and go, that's just another arrest. So you start to understand the environment that these officers are working in, this top-down environment where they are trained to believe that that is an appropriate way to subdue a suspect. So you start to realize it's not just, oh, well, these officers are bad or hateful. When an environment has been created that people assume that this is business as usual on both sides, that's when you get to a point where engagement and conversation, it no longer works because we don't see each other in appropriate manners.
And before we go to break, in case people forgot about where that footage came from, it was a couple that lived across the street from where it happened, and they just bought a new camera, and I bet it was a clunky big camera.
Big, giant camcorder was still sitting in the box. This gentleman, George Holiday, he was sleeping with his wife. They heard all these sirens. He told her to go, you know, pick up the film. You know, they're in bed. They're like, who wants to bother? And he just happened to have a camcorder, happened to have the batteries in. You know, again, we're so used to cell phone footage. At that time, it was, and I don't mean this in a glib fashion, but it was like getting a shot of Bigfoot, of something that was mythical, truly mythical, these kinds of beatings. Mm-hmm. But until that point, until people could see it, they could not believe that something like this could possibly happen to another human being. And it really changed the course of LA, of LA policing, of how we engage. Clearly, obviously, a year later with the uprising, it really changed the trajectory of the city.
John Ridley's new documentary is Let It Fall, Los Angeles, 1982 to 1992. It opens tomorrow at the Roxy in San Francisco, and you can see a trailer at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KLW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or a question at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will be discussing media coverage of Donald Trump pardoning Joe Arpaio. And speaking of what happened before the pardon, we're going to talk about the history of Joe Arpaio in Arizona with someone who made a documentary about him and has interviewed him many times. And then we're also going to talk about the devastating hurricanes that we're seeing in Texas. And then we'll also talk about what we're not hearing much about, what's happening in Bangladesh, Nepal, and India. That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by filmmaker John Ridley. He is out with a new documentary, Let It Fall, Los Angeles, 1982 to 1992. It's about the 1992 LA uprising, racial and economic inequality, the police brutality that fueled that violence. But it doesn't just start there. It looks at what happened before Rodney King was brutally kicked and beaten with a metal baton. And we're going to talk about what went on behind the scenes at the LAPD. They came up with these tactics and used them constantly. And if you have any questions or comments for John Ridley, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. If you remember that time, if you were in LA, or if you were just horrified and glued to your TV screens, like so many people around the globe, we'd love to hear from you. And what has changed since then? 866-798-8255. And let's hear from Jose in Oakland. Hi, Jose. Welcome to the show.
Hello. How are you guys doing this morning? I look forward to seeing this movie.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
I was in L.A. I grew up in Los Angeles, and I left L.A. in 1988. But it's really good that you're documenting from 82 to 92, and you are correct. There were incidents that were not captured prior to that. One in particular that I'd like to bring to your attention was the cruising in East L.A. on Whittier Boulevard. And what wound up happening there was one gentleman who was working for a lowrider magazine at the time. The name is Roberto Rodriguez, who is now teaching at the University of Arizona. And he was there just on the sidewalk taking pictures and for the magazine. And he witnessed East L.A. County sheriffs doing a pre-Rodney King on an individual. That's so he starts taking pictures. Next thing you know, they start beating him up, and they charged him with assault with a deadly weapon, and his weapon was his camera. Mm-hmm. And they took his film, and he nearly died. He nearly died in custody, but he was able to write a book, and it was called Assault with a Deadly Weapon. And it was an independent, but I think he's reissued it, and you might be able to find it with other books that he's written. But yeah, you are correct. You know, 82, it got caught, but prior to that, there were other things that were being done, not only in South Central, but in other parts of the greater LA area. And it's systemic.
Hmm.
You know, you guys are very, very correct. It is systemic. And I like the comment about putting up a piece of art that would solve it. It's supposed to engage dialogue. And I'm just glad that you guys, that you made this movie. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Jose. Thank you for that story. Going back again, John, to 82, in the film, so many people talk about how cocaine and PCP were easily available, sometimes for as little as $5.
Yeah.
Systemic poverty.
It's one of those things, I don't know if people remember the crack cocaine era and what it was like in communities, because there weren't a lot of jobs. It was easy to sell drugs, make drugs, or have drugs that were imported. And there are still questions about where those drugs exactly were coming from, how they ended up in the community. Mm-hmm. So it became a way of life and certainly a way of death. And one of the things that we want to get into in the story, one of the things we do get into in Let It Fall, is that as long as that way of life and way of death was contained within the South Central area, it was largely, I don't want to say mm-hmm. quite accepted, but tolerated or dealt with. But there was an incident in, I believe it was 88, where a young lady in Westwood, the Westwood section, which if you know Los Angeles area, it's one of the most upscale areas and nightlife restaurants. And very unfortunately, there was a rivalry shooting between two young men who were in different gangs, or at the very least had a beef, and a young lady was unfortunately shot and killed. And because of where it happened, because of the perception of what it meant, and some would say because this young lady who was shot was Asian, because she wasn't black, and therefore she wasn't black, sort of represented white, and mm-hmm. one of the things we just get into is race and how it's perceived and all of that. The response from the LAPD was then to essentially begin what was called Operation Hammer. And as we say in the documentary, or some of the officers talk about, you know, it was called Operation Hammer because it was dropping the hammer. And some would say a disproportional response to what was happening. But because it happened in one of the quote-unquote nice neighborhoods, then there was this impetus to move, to go, to do something. So these complicated reactions, whether you call it a reaction, overreaction, lack of reaction to what was happening previously, it just was not easy to deal with. But that's one of the things we want to talk about, is complicated nature.
Karen Toshima is the woman that you're talking about,
yes.
And you interviewed her brother, Kevin.
Yes.
It was an incredible interview. For me, it was amazing to hear Kevin say, a lot of people were angry because Karen got so much media attention, deservedly so. Yeah. But people in South Central did not get that kind of media attention when they were killed. And Karen Toshima's brother, Kevin, said, I understand their frustration.
Here's the thing that was very important to us, is that folks who have been through tragedies or moments like this have, in my opinion, a deeper, larger capacity for empathy than a lot of us who are privileged enough to sit on the sideline with our opinion. And it was very important for us to make sure that this story wasn't just literally black or white or police, you know, citizens against police. And the Asian American community, the Hispanic community, police officers in their own voices talking about how difficult it was to police at that time period, about the top-down structure that oftentimes didn't allow for them to make critical decisions. And there's one officer, again, I don't want to give away too many of these stories because of the way they play out, but one of the officers, Lisa Phillips, in her narrative, and talking about the decisions that she made and she had to make during the uprising because she couldn't live with herself if she didn't make certain very critical decisions. But it was very important for us, again, to allow a space where people could tell their stories, these broad-based stories that at the end, you know, they move because these individuals, again, gave themselves over to a higher power.
After this killing happened in Westwood, as you said, police response was swift. They tripled patrols in the area to show the public a massive show of force. A lot of the footage that you have in the film shows people saying they were scared to go out in Westwood. And the idea behind this Operation Hammer was to make as many arrests as possible and to force as many gang members, young black men, really, off of the streets. And I want to play a clip, and this doesn't give away the stories, but I think it's really powerful. In this clip, you will hear from retired Captain Thomas Elfmont, retired Captain Paul Jefferson, South Central resident Donnell Alexander, retired Lieutenant Michael Mullen, and Chief of Police of L.A., Daryl Gates. This is a clip from John Ridley's new documentary, Let It Fall, Los Angeles, 1982 to 1992.
The thinking was, okay, if we have an unbelievably bad area, what we need to do is saturate that area for 2 or 3 days and make as many arrests as we can for anything.
You know, we had to look for probable cause to stop them. It could be a traffic violation, jaywalking, or whatever it be, and search them, run them for warrants, and see if you come up with guns or contraband or something.
Police call it Operation Hammer, and its purpose is to force as many gang members as possible off the streets of Los Angeles.
Police would plant drugs on you. Police would set you up. They would use snitches. Police would, they would take your money. I mean, you know what I'm saying? And regularly.
Operation Hammer was a, for lack of a better word, it's a free ticket to go out there and do overly aggressive police work.
So they would come in and say, drop the hammer on them. That's where the term comes in.
LAPD would put 1,000 officers on a Friday and Saturday night into different neighborhoods and set up a jail situation for mass bookings. And the officers would go out and just arrest and arrest and arrest.
Tonight, we'll be out in even more force.
Please,
have at least 300 officers, probably more.
Step to the wall. Step to the wall. Get down on your knees when you get to the wall. Passenger, get out.
What we're doing is really putting the gangs on notice.
The LAPD broke through the rear of what police are calling a rock house.
One of the things I just want to say is at that time also you have to understand that that gang became synonymous with black. Mm. So they were breaking into houses, calling them crack houses, and they maybe communal houses, maybe they found some drugs, but certainly not in sufficient quantity to justify using battering rams or tearing places apart. So
battering rams, can you describe that?
So they would have these, I mean, essentially these wheeled tanks that did not have necessarily any firearms on them, but they had a battering ram that was maybe 15 feet long, steel with a flat metal surface that they would drive into the back of the house and tear it open, which was not necessarily effective because you could hear it coming. Mm. You could not see what you were smashing the ram into. It was not a – and look, we have officers in there talking about this was not an effective way to do what needed to be done, but it was more about sending a message and more about getting to a place where message – where anyone felt a message needed to be sent. So again, just a downward spiral in terms of how policing was done. And police officers – and I really want to stress this because we did want to go to police officers and let them talk about this was not – you know, this was not community policing. This did not make it easy for us to go and do our job. And then you have people in the community who end up looking at police as being an occupying force. So that's where the top-down principle, as opposed to officers on the street going, hey, this is what we need to do our job. This is what we need to engage. This is what we need to be part of the community, but being ignored mm-hmm. in terms of how they could be better suited to do their job, which was to protect and to serve.
And in the film Let It Fall, you have very disturbing footage of the aftermath of what is this thing called again?
The battering ram.
The battering ram.
But there's particularly a raid called 39th and Dalton, where there was Tom Elfmont, who was a commander in the area, who was trying to respond to gang intimidation of a regular family, but ended up passing off these orders mm. that just got moved through the chain, again, to individuals who did not have that same care and concern about the neighborhood. They sent in some a drug squad of officers who basically ransacked a house that was largely occupied by just regular, average, everyday citizens, but again, did so to send a message that drugs or lifestyle will not be tolerated. So, again, you know, one of the things we want to get at is just it's not about solutions. It's not about – we would go to people and we'd say, look, we're not here to exonerate you, mm-hmm. but we're also not here to indict. If people don't walk away with an understanding of how complex these issues are, it does us no good to simplify, and it does us no good to set up straw people. What we need to do is to set up individuals, the complexity – of people, because that's what we're dealing with, is complex individuals, complex circumstances.
That footage was just brutal because the homes were just completely trashed. I mean, drawers, mattresses, everything was just trashed, torn apart.
And we have officers, again, who look at it and go, this is no way to police mm-hmm. because we can't collect evidence. Even if this was a drug house, how do we collect evidence? How do we prove things beyond they were trash?
And you have mom there, baby, sister there.
People lived there. Right. Families lived there.
Speaking of policing, Donald Jones in your film really stood out for me. He was a police officer from 1983 to 2003. And he said that when white men are pulled over, police are enforcing the law. But when black men are pulled over, it's about control. Put your hands on the steering wheel. Don't move. And people are screaming when they're saying this. Don't reach for anything. Don't move until I tell you to move. And there's disturbing footage of a white cop who's screaming at a young black man saying, put your hands on your head. I don't know if you have a knife. The young man says, I don't have a knife. The police officer says, put your hands on your head and turn around. And then he proceeds to slam the young black boy's head into a store window and the glass shatters.
Yeah, it's harrowing. And I think Don, as an officer, he was also paramedic rescue. I mean, this is a guy who served and he understood that sometimes these encounters, not sometimes, but in his opinion, they were set up very differently. And as he said, you know, sometimes when a white person is pulled over, it's, you know, did you realize you were speeding? Do you know why I stopped you? It's a conversation as opposed to dictates and commands. Do this, do that. And commanded with a voice of perhaps a little bit beyond authority. And you're a young kid, you get pulled over. It's frightening. It's scary. You make a sudden move, and you know it could go in a very, very wrong direction. And then to see the footage where someone, again, their head is shoved through plate glass. You see these sheets of glass raining down. It's frightening. And we have to ask ourselves, you know, again, this is footage from 25 years ago. Why does this continue? Mm-hmm. Why does this fear continue? Why do these outsized events, if you're a young black male, 2.5 times more likely to be shot and killed by an officer. So this isn't just, you know, these rough engagement. 2.5 times more likely to end up dead in a casual encounter. Shouldn't say casual, but, you know, an encounter between a police officer and citizenry.
I think it's such a good point, though, that you're being yelled at. You don't have time to tell your story. Put your hands here. Do this. Whereas with white people, it's about, okay, here's why I pulled you over, and you have time to share your story. Donald Jones, who was a police officer with the LAPD, when you spoke with him, what did he tell you about what we're dealing with now and why so much has not changed?
Really talked about these systemic issues. This just when individuals are pulled over, what's the assumption? That they perhaps innocently broke the law, or there is a reason for what they're doing, or they're not likely to necessarily be carrying a firearm. One of the things that was very interesting in our documentary, we had officers who were talking about Rodney King. And they would assert that, you know, because of his size, because that he wasn't responding, he was tased first, and then obviously was beaten, and in their opinion, was not pain compliant, which means when, you know, it hurts enough, you listen. And because he wasn't pain compliant, well, he must be on PCPs. But then the officers would say, well, I assumed he was on PCP. I don't know because I'd never been involved with someone on PCPs before. So that to me was very interesting. It wasn't that they had stopped 10, 20, 15, 30 individuals. They knew what they were looking at. They'd been in this situation before. It's that based on stories that they'd been told, based on systemic things, well, it's a sizable black man in a car, cheap-looking car, speeding late at night, taser didn't work, not just that he's big or his pain tolerance is different, got to be on PCP, and therefore, not only do I have to then hit him, I need to hit him again and again and again and again and again.
And this is related. When you look at the chokeholds, and there were two different kinds of chokeholds, LA Chief of Police Daryl Gates said about chokeholds, in some blacks, when it's applied, the veins or arteries do not open as fast as they do in normal people.
Yeah, what he was talking about is once the chokehold is slackened, you know, the blood should rush back. You know, it's done to render someone unconscious. And once it's slackened, blood should begin to flow again from the heart to the brain, and everything should be, quote-unquote, okay. And the chief said that it doesn't happen the same way, quote, you know, with blacks as it does in, quote-unquote, normal people. Mm. Obviously, individuals were outraged by the idea that blacks are not normal. The chief would made it about, well, I'm talking about, you know, physiology and things like that. And but that concept of who's normal and who isn't, not in some people or other people or under some circumstances, you know, normal people. Again, that is this top-down psychology. So when the individual at the very top is espousing things like this, you know, look, I don't want to overly draw parallels and comparisons, but, you know, you can look at what's happening right now in America, and you have an individual at the top who is, in my opinion, perhaps winking and nodding to other individuals and saying, yeah, you know, so what? Or you can fly in the face of the Constitution, don't worry about it, you're going to get a pass. You're going to be able to walk the bases. That's fine. It makes a difference. We can't pretend that it doesn't make a difference.
John Ridley's new documentary is Let It Fall, Los Angeles, 1982 to 1992. It looks at the Rodney King beating, the acquittal, the violence that ensued. But he looks at what happened before that. The Rodney King riots did not start with Rodney King. They began 10 years earlier. And the film opens tomorrow at the Roxy here in San Francisco. We have just a couple minutes left, John. What has changed in South Central Los Angeles?
You know, a lot has changed with the Los Angeles Police Department, I will say that. They have transformed themselves. It has not been an easy transformation for those who remember the Rampart scandal. It was real growth. But a lot of what's changed, I think, hopefully in the best ways, is they really are more of a community policing organization, really trying to get out into communities and head off issues and problems. Unfortunately, within South Central, there are many issues that have not changed. I think the drug crisis doesn't remain as it did before. But in terms of socioeconomic issues, I think because of Los Angeles generally, there was a rising tide. That's been good. But, you know, we can't assume that because my circumstances or one's circumstances are good, everyone's circumstances are good. And as Los Angeles has grown, as there's been this boon, particularly post the Great Recession, South Central had been overlooked. You know, not a lot of money has been poured in. Money is coming in. Unfortunately, with money arriving now, there's a lot of people being displaced. Mm-hmm. And that tends to be, unfortunately, how problems are historically solved in distressed neighborhoods is money comes in and people are displaced and those issues then get moved to other neighborhoods. So things have changed, but we can't assume that either things are where they need to be for everyone or that all issues have been resolved, because when this happens again, we can't assume that it's going to look the way it did previously. Mm-hmm. We have to identify where issues are and how are we moving into communities to make sure that they feel that they're franchised the way they need to be.
In addition to racism and police brutality, poverty and inequality is also so important to talk about. And Los Angeles is, there's a lot of inequality. I mean, up and down our state.
A lot of inequality. And I have to say that is, you know, we think about race, we think about police, but you look at Baltimore, the race has changed, who's in charge, that changes, but these systemic issues mm-hmm. remain. And unfortunately, when people find themselves at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum, they're more likely to obviously be involved in spaces where they cannot advocate. So it's beyond race. It's so much about class as well. And that is where this divide continues to widen, and that is the problem that we face.
What are you hoping comes from this film, John? You have screened it in front of a number of audiences, including the LAPD, as yeah. it opens tomorrow nationally. That we're having such a deep conversation
engagement.
In this country.
That's what I hope thoughts? For. You know, if I can go to the LAPD and these individuals, these officers can feel as though their story has been fairly represented, and also the changes that have been made have been represented. It's when we start to try to have engagement and it becomes more about finger-pointing and anger than it does really about advocacy and engagement. That's where the problem is. I hope that this film can be used as a source of engagement among communities.
John Ridley's documentary, new documentary, is Let It Fall, Los Angeles, 1982 to 1992. It opens tomorrow at the Roxy in San Francisco. A shorter version will air on ABC next...
No, a shorter version aired on ABC way back in April. But that version does not exist. This is the full-length feature. This is the only version, and it's certainly the version that we want people to see.
And it opens tomorrow across the country, tomorrow at the Roxy here in San Francisco. You can find the trailer at yourcallradio.org. John Ridley is an Oscar-winning screenwriter, director, and novelist. He's best known for his 2013 film, 12 Years a Slave, for which he won the Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. Again, the new documentary is Let It Fall, Los Angeles. 1982 to 1992. John, thank you so much for the film and thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. Deeply appreciate it.
Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. You can find out more about our show or podcast at yourcallradio.org. You can also podcast at iTunes. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer, and you can find out more at Your Call Radio. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.